Coming up on Fronteras, water experts say the Southwest should get used to the idea of drinking recycled water as treatment plants become more sophisticated.
And if you analyzed it, you would discover that it is every bit as pure as the stuff you pay $1.79 a liter for, you know, at the grocery store.
Our water series, Pipe Dreams, takes a closer look at recycled water. And water czar Pat Mulroy has just retired. She leaves behind a big legacy and big lessons about the Colorado River during this record drought.
There won't be winners and losers. And if there is a collapse, it will be a systemic collapse throughout the system. Everybody will be affected. Everybody will be hurt.
A profile of Pat Mulroy on Fronteras. But first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created through an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among several public radio stations. I'm Crystal Chavez. California is coping with the worst drought in recorded history. California's governor has asked state residents to cut back water use by 20%. The rest of the Southwest is also experiencing extreme to severe drought. In the first of a water series we're calling Pipe Dreams, Laurel Morales went to Las Vegas to talk to a woman who has redefined water management in the West, outgoing water czar Pat Mulroy.
It's Pat Mulroy's last day on the job. A few miles outside the Las Vegas Strip, the Southern Nevada water manager looks out at the skyline.
Look at the high rises. Those aren't all hotels. Those are apartments and condo units. People are living in a much more urban setting than the Las Vegas that I moved to in 1974.
That's just one of the changes, at least partly engineered by Mulroy. This petite woman with intense blue eyes says changing people's minds about conservation and about big grassy lawns and their sprawling developments wasn't easy.
Well, about as easy as taking an ocean liner and turning it 180 degrees and going in the other direction. People were panicked.
Beginning in the mid-90s, Mulroy faced competing pressures from developers, a growing population, and a diminishing water supply. So she came up with solutions, controversial solutions, like buying up water rights, recharging Lake Mead with recycled water, and ripping out lawns. With financial incentives from the Water Authority since 1997, Las Vegans have ripped up more than 160 million square feet of grass, replacing it with desertscapes. Mulroy says the hardest person to convince to tear out his lawn was her husband.
He was a tough nut to crack because he had the I was here first, the old Western attitude.
Pat Mulroy has her critics who say she never allowed water limitations to hold back growth in the city, instead spent millions of dollars on obtaining water rights. She's quick to point out that Las Vegas has become a global model for water conservation. In the same time the population has grown 25%, they've reduced their use of the Colorado River by a third. Her mantra?
It's not about whether you grow, it's about how you grow.
It's not whether we grow, but it's how we grow.
Sound familiar? That's John Ensminger, Mulroy's replacement. He's been trained well, but he has his work cut out for him. The biggest challenge? Building a $15 billion pipeline to bring water 300 miles from eastern Nevada ranchland to Las Vegas.
I think it would be imprudent, to say the very least, not to have a safety net in case things go from bad to catastrophic on the Colorado.
Nevada, along with Southern California and much of Arizona, still relies almost entirely on the Colorado River for water. The River Compact, signed nearly a century ago, gave Nevada the smallest allotment. That's why, 2 decades ago, when Mulroy first sat down at the table with the other state's water delegates, nobody took her state seriously.
You know, the joke on the river was always that Nevada's delegate was drunk under a bar table somewhere in Santa Fe. I've had that story told to me a jillion times. And I've said, well, we've woken up. If we've been in a slumber, the slumber's over.
Mulroy developed a workaround to Nevada's tiny allotment. Now Las Vegas recharges the reservoir with recycled water, so it actually banks some of its water. Still, the lake is now half empty, threatening supplies to the rest of the region. Mulroy says all seven of the River Compact states have to come up with a solution together.
There won't be winners and losers, and if there is a collapse, it will be a systemic collapse throughout the system. Everybody will be affected. Everybody will be hurt.
In years to come, the solution will be in new technology, Mulroy believes, like a breakthrough in desalination and strategies that will help farmers grow more with less water. I'm Laurel Morales in Flagstaff.
Most people are squeamish about the notion of consuming recycled wastewater. But experts say we might have to get used to the idea given our current drought and the growing population in the Southwest. Now, in part two of our series, Pipe Dreams, we learn how wastewater in Las Vegas gets clean enough to drink. Laurel Morales reports.
In Las Vegas, all the water that cleans the dishes, hits the shower drain, or is flushed down the toilet is recycled at this plant. The waste flows through 2,000 miles of pipes to arrive in a torrent here. Jeff Mills is the assistant manager.
What you're standing on right now, this is where everything comes in.
Mills holds up a plastic container of what's called influent, the waste piped into the plant.
If you take a look at it, it's not probably as dark as what you might think, because 99.9% has carrier water, basically bringing it down the collection system.
So, take your picture with it?
Sure. Definitely not a glamour shot, right?
Mills takes me through step by step how everything is filtered out. Eggshells, coffee grounds, and sludge. He explains how the good bacteria eat up chemicals harmful to the environment. And finally, how ultraviolet light bulbs disinfect the water. Water pollution control laws in the 1940s and 50s provided federal money to build wastewater treatment plants like this one. Much of that water is now reused on golf courses, in air conditioners, and car washes. In some cases, it flows back into the environment, like the Las Vegas Wash.
If you kind of come in and the fish don't see you, you should see a good half dozen good-sized carp.
Oh.
Yeah, there's one right there.
Wow. They're big.
Yeah, they are big.
From the Las Vegas Wash, the water flows 25 miles downstream to Lake Mead, the massive reservoir that supplies water to Southern California and Arizona. But the recharge won't do much to bolster Lake Mead. It's so low, the Southern Nevada Water Authority is building a new pipe to pump water to Las Vegas. Engineering project manager Erica Moonen takes me to a platform where I can look down a 600-foot deep shaft. It's 30 feet in diameter.
Whoa.
Warm, humid air mists up my camera lens and my glasses. Moonen says they're building this pipeline to take cleaner water from the bottom of the lake.
That treated wastewater gets trapped at the surface. So if we're deep enough, it doesn't really influence. We don't see the influence of that treated wastewater coming in and into our intakes.
Some water experts worry about what the wastewater treatment plants don't remove. Traces of pharmaceutical drugs, for instance. Robert Glennon is the author of Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It.
Now, they're in exceedingly small doses measured in the parts per trillion, but they're still powerful chemicals, and we don't know what the maximum safe exposure level is for any one of these chemicals. Never mind that it's really a veritable cocktail mix of chemicals.
So far, research shows no harmful health impacts in places like Namibia, where people are already drinking recycled water without an environmental buffer like a lake. But more studies need to be done. In the meantime, Glennon says that water can be used on parks or to wash cars.
When most of us think about the water that we have, we think of it as though it were like air, infinite and inexhaustible, when for all practical purposes, it's very finite and very exhaustible.
That's why the Southwest is relying more and more on recycled water to stretch the supply. I'm Laurel Morales in Flagstaff.
There's still more Fronteras coming up. A new exhibit brings the story of the Alamo's Tejano defenders to life.
I think history can be a unifying thing if everybody feels like they're represented in that history.
More after a quick break. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. A GED is supposed to open the door to higher-paying jobs and more education for people without a high school diploma. But research shows people who pass the test earn less than high school grads and were less likely to go to college. Education reporter Kyla Calvert of San Diego tells us changes to the GED this year are meant to raise the bar, but they're also raising concerns.
Some students in this GED prep class look like they could still be in a regular high school.
What are the two ways we can name this one up here?
Fourth
to the second or?
Fourth to the square.
Square.
Others could have a grandchild in high school, but each of them hopes passing the GED will be what it takes to change their life. Myesha Jones started taking GED classes in September. She wants to study psychology after passing the tests.
I wanted to go to college, and I took time off because I had my kids to raise them, but now I have a junior and a senior, so I decided to go back for myself.
Her classmate Bonnie Arias started studying for the GED 3 years ago, hoping it would get her back in the job market.
I was injured at work when I was 30 years old, and I was working at Pizza Hut, so I'm a fast food worker. So anyway, I thought maybe someone might hire me, but with a little bit of knowledge.
But the GED finish line they're working toward moved on January 1st. Today, their teacher, Trenton Watkins, is giving his first lesson on square roots.
All right, so a square root is a number which, when it's multiplied by itself, it gives you another number. And I'll explain what that means.
We've had to toss in some new math topics, as well on language arts. They switched the essay from a basic five-paragraph essay based upon opinion to now it being an evidence-based essay, so that now the students have to learn to cite evidence, use quotations, and things like that.
The company that designs the GED revamped the exams to put them more in line with higher English and math standards for high school graduates. GED test takers now have to pass 4 instead of 5 exams. They have to be prepared with more critical thinking and complex problem-solving skills, and they'll have to do more writing in subjects like math and science. Plus, pencil and paper are out. The new tests have to be taken on a computer. Lori Crosby Howell is dean of San Diego Community College's GED program.
It raises the bar. I read some research that even the most prepared students that leave high school or adult ed are still 4 levels below what they need to be successful in college. So with raising the bar with the new GED, teaching the college and career readiness skills, it's exactly what's needed right now.
Myesha Jones says she was nervous when she first heard about the changes, but so far this semester, the work seems manageable.
The class is the same. It's just more new material, and I think we go a little bit more in depth with the material.
Bonnie Arias was more alarmed.
I said, oh no, I'm not going to go in and pay for a test where I could fail it, especially at the end.
About 20% of their classmates failed to pass the old exams. Now they have to start all over. To help students prepare, the San Diego Community College program has added classes to teach the computer skills they'll need to pass the new exams. They've also spent about $35,000 on new textbooks. John Broma wonders if those changes will be enough to help students across the finish line. He's a professor and counselor who works with students with disabilities.
The test, from what we've seen, looks to be far more abstract and far more high-level material that a lot of our students may struggle with, because depending on their disability, particularly when it's a cognitive disability, abstract information is the toughest thing to process.
Broma and others are concerned raising the bar may cut more people off from opportunities instead of improve their prospects.
De facto, if you don't have a GED or high school diploma, most places won't hire you. So are we going to put that out of reach of people who aren't destined for a 4-year diploma or what?
Questions like this have led some states to give up on the GED. They're using one of 2 new companies offering alternative high school equivalency tests. And what California will do is still up in the air. So more changes could be in store for students like Myesha Jones and Bonnie Arias. In San Diego, I'm Kyla Calvert.
A new exhibit has opened in San Antonio. Standing Their Ground, Tejanos at the Alamo casts new light on the story of the Alamo siege and battle. At this first-of-its-kind exhibit at the Shrine of Texas Liberty, people will learn about the role of Tejanos in defending the Alamo. Here to tell me more about the exhibit is Mark Lambert, Deputy Commissioner of Archives and Records at the Texas General Land Office.
Tejanos were probably kind of in the frying pan when the revolution started. You could either choose to side with your, you know, patria, with your country, Mexico, and stay loyal. You could fight with the revolutionaries, or probably the best case for most of them was to remain neutral. You know, everybody's heard about Travis Crockett and Bowie. Many of the people that fought with them were recent immigrants. They didn't have anything to fight for. The Tejanos, who had established a society here, they're the ones with the bacon in the fire. They had the biggest, hardest choices to make, I think. So the goal, I mean, this academic literature has kind of researched the Tejano role for about the last 40 years, but it's, as far as we know, this type of exhibit's never been at the Alamo before. And because we are an archive, we want to get the primary source documents, meaning the records that proof up, show that they were part of the garrison there, that there was women and children, Tejanos in the building during the battle, because it's been repeated for 100 years that Susanna Dickinson and her daughter Angelina were the only female survivors of the battle. Well, no, there was at least 9 Tejanos who were in there as well, who, if didn't see much, at least heard the horrors and lived through it.
How many Tejano fighters were there?
Well, the documentation is sketchy, but we have records of 8, and so we have official records showing that their service, that they died, and somebody either got a land grant because of their service, or there's some later documentation of it. We have one Tejano who hid at the end of the battle and so survived it and somehow bluffed his way through Santa Ana, so he didn't believe he had fought. And then there was 5 Tejanos, basically Juan Seguin and people in his cavalry company, who were basically ordered out or would have died. They were ordered out as couriers. And so they survived, and there's paper documentation on them. And then the Tejanos, it was a little more difficult unless they were related to somebody who had died at the battle and they got a land grant later. You know, if they, it's harder to find the documentation for them, but we have records of the 9.
Why do you think we haven't heard much about the role of Tejanos in the Alamo? I mean, this is the first exhibit of its kind. Why hasn't it been a part of the popular narrative, do you think?
I think popular history lags far behind academic history, and I think academics have been researching this for the last 40 years, but you have to kind of turn into a general narrative to get it out to the public. And if the average person is not going to pick up the 300-page history book and get all this, you have to get it to them somehow, you know, brochures, exhibits, audio, video, and then we have an audio video portion of this exhibit. I mean, you can call it popularizing, but getting it, to me, biteable pieces to get out to the general public, and then the primary source documents. You know, everybody thinks of it as a narrative written by some kind of worldly person who looks down at all this past history and writes a narrative, but that's pulled from our primary source documents we have in our archives, so we thought that was important to get that out there for people to see and look at.
What kind of documents? Like, what will we find there?
One of the most amazing ones to me, and this is borrowed from the Bexar County Archives, is the marriage certificate between James Bowie and Ursula Veramendi, the Veramendis being one of the most important Tejano families in San Antonio at the time. And so that shows the melding of cultures. I mean, James Bowie was definitely not a Johnny-come-lately who was just fighting to get some free land. He had settled here. He married into an important family, which many times when cultures interact, you know, they kind of collide, and then this accommodations happen, like marrying into the family. You know, Native Americans and Anglos did it on the frontier, and the American Southwest, it happened all the time. So that kind of shows, you know, the Tejano culture, of course, was Spaniards and indigenous. That turns into the whole mestizaje, or the mixing of cultures, and Anglos and Tejanos mixing. And so that's a neat document to me. Juan Seguin's birth certificate, it's a copy, but he was born in San Antonio and had this copy of his birth certificate added to our records later as proof for him getting a land grant under Mexico. And one of the neat ones to me is we have a Bexar County clerk return. After the revolution, you had to go in front of a local board of commissioners to prove that you had been in Texas before March 2nd, 1836, and you were due a land grant. And so Juan Seguin went in front of the Bexar County Board of Land Commissioners, and obviously it was an Anglo writing his name down because this is John N. Seguin, and he presented proof that he had been in Texas before March 2nd, 1836, when we declared independence. So he was due for a headright grant, which was a league and a labor, which was 4,600 acres. Four lines below that, it wasn't exactly on the same day, but four lines below that is somebody showing up as a representative of David Crockett, the deceased. David Crockett, Davy Crockett, who had died at the Alamo. His son showed up in the same month and asked for the land grant for his father having been in Texas before March 2nd, 1836. So in, I think it's July of 1837, Robert Crockett, the son of David Crockett, was in San Antonio and once again was here as a colonel with the Texas Army still, and of course reuniting his community and being the local military chieftain. Did they interact? Did they talk to each other? What kind of stories could you get about how you saw my dad at the Alamo? I mean, it's just, you know, you bring it down to a personal level or a social level, like what could have happened there? I mean, it's just amazing stories.
What do you think the public will get from these stories? What impact will it have to know these stories, do you think, in this modern society?
Well, I think history can be a unifying thing if everybody feels like they're represented in that history. I think it's in the last 10, 20 years, things have changed at the Alamo, but, you know, the Tejano community in Texas and San Antonio didn't feel like, I mean, they know they were an important part of Texas history, but they didn't feel like they were represented in Texas history. Our goal is to get all those voices, get all those people, get all those cultures in Texas history. You know, everybody has a right to be proud of their Texas ancestry, to get all those people into that. I mean, this is a melting pot, to get all those people in that history, but people have to feel like they're included in that narrative before they make it part of them, part of their culture, part of their family history. You know, from there you go from personal history, family history, you know, local and regional history, national history, international history. This is a neat history to me because you're not only talking about Texas, you're talking about Mexico. They're like joined at the hip. How do we get along? What are our differences? How do we work those differences out? It's better to know your past so you can move forward.
That was Mark Lambert, Deputy Commissioner of Archives and Records at the Texas General Land Office, talking about the new exhibit in San Antonio, Standing Their Ground, Tejanos at the Alamo. The exhibit at the Alamo is free and open to the public. It runs through June 6th. You've been listening to Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations along the Southwest. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.